Now, recently there's been a film about the suffragettes. I'm not going to talk about that because I haven't seen it. I'm going to let anyone who has seen it make any contributions during the contributions part of the meeting. But anyway, the story we tend to hear about the suffragettes is about how heroic actions by a small number of women, the suffragettes, finally persuaded the male establishment to grant women the vote in 1918. Now, the truth is actually far more complicated than that. There were a good bit in Socialist Worker a couple of weeks ago, which says that the fight for women's suffrage was already many decades old when Emmeline, Christabel, Sylvia and Adela Pankhurst created the Women's Social and Political Union in 1903. In other words, the fight for women's for votes for women had been going on since the mid-Victorian era. And the name suffragettes was actually a name coined by the Daily Mail, presumably intended to have negative consequences. You know what the bloody Daily Mail are like for the WPSU. But it was not only accepted by the WPSU, it became synonymous with the entire struggle for votes for women. Only trouble is, as Socialist Worker continues, there was never one homogeneous movement of women from all backgrounds in favour of votes for women. Alice Milne, a working class supporter, visited the WPSU offices in 1906 and described her discomfort at seeing the place full of fashionable ladies in silks and satins having tea and cakes. In other words, middle class, possibly even ruling class women who one would not normally expect such people to lead any sort of resistance to the system. Yet such was the establishment's intransigence against change. Even these women joined the fight. And to be fair, fight they certainly did. There's absolutely no doubting their commitment to the cause. They used tactics such as chaining themselves to railings, setting fire to mailbox contents, smashing windows, occasionally detonating bombs. Now, one kind of Lulsworthy tactic was when one-day golfers around the country arrived to play and found the slogan "Votes for Women" burned in acid across their greens. Now, these acts of direct action often led the suffragettes to jail, and while in jail they went on hunger strike and were tortured by being force-fed. And what's more, one suffragette, Emily Davison, she died under the King's Horse Hammer at the Epsom Derby on 4th of June 1913, quite possibly while trying to pin a Votes for Women banner onto King's Horse. So, they were certainly not lacking commitment. Their biggest flaw, however, was that they relied on these heroic acts by a few brave women on behalf of the majority of women, and they didn't. In fact, they couldn't involve the masses. For example, friends of the Pankhursts were welcomed on release from prison with a testimonial banquet at the Savoy Hotel on London Strand. Now, most women wouldn't even have been allowed anywhere near the Savoy Hotel. And what's more, despite them being radical when it came to votes for women, in other ways, they were sometimes utterly reactionary. This became evident when World War One broke out in 1914. Emmeline Pankhurst announced the suspension of the suffrage campaign to support the ruling class war effort in 1914. She actually supported the imperialist World War One. The Suffragette newspaper was renamed Britannia in 1915, and the Pankhursts whipped up a jingoistic campaign. They gave white feathers to men who they thought should be fighting for their country. Now, if they gave me a white feather, I'd wear it with pride, but then. And they also denounced workers who went on strike. And they called the campaign the Anti-Bolshevik Campaign. Following the war, Emmeline campaigned on the evils of venereal disease and the need for male chastity, and she joined the Tories, standing as a candidate in Stepney in East London in 1927. Emmeline and Christabel both volunteered in the Women's Special Police Force during the 1926 general strike to try to break the strike. They were utterly opposed to working class fight back. Adela emigrated to Australia, and even worse, she became a fascist, and she was interned during the Second World War because she supported the Nazis. So that really is a case of read it and weep. But before we dismiss the suffragettes as a bunch of middle-class single-issue do-gooders, there is another side to the struggle, another side that's deeply rooted in the working class. The years leading up to the First World War saw the Great Unrest, which was an explosion of trade union organisation and militancy, and women were very much part of this. In 1911 alone, there were 10 million strike days, and at the same time, the British ruling class faced rising resistance to its imperialist rule in Ireland. It's against this backdrop that women in Lancashire's cotton mills formed the core of a movement of radical suffragists. For them, the fight for the vote was inseparable from the fight against the bosses. For one example, Selina Cooper, a cotton worker, had worked in the mills from the age of seven, so she's going to be one of the young girls you were seeing depictions of the Victorian dreadful cotton mills, one of the child labourers back in the day in the history books and what have you, about as far removed from the privileged lives of the Pankhursts as you can get. And Selina campaigned all over the northwest of England to win trade unions to women's suffrage. Speaking at one open-air public meeting in Wigan in 1906, she argued that working women had their own aims and do not want their political power to enable them to boast they are on equal terms with men, but to use it for the same purposes as working-class men, to get better conditions. Now, it was this movement that inspired Sylvia Pankhurst, who I'll come back to later. Now, both middle-class suffragettes and working-class suffragists, they did often campaign, organise and march together. Now, it's hardly surprising that they had to campaign together because ever since the Victorian era, some trade unions and trade unionists still had the reactionary ideas about a woman's place being in the home. And furthermore, within the Labour movement, arguments raged about whether to support a law giving women the vote on the same basis as men, as many working class men were still excluded. Indeed, some in the Labour Party dismissed such a law as a ladies' bill, saying it would benefit the Tories as only better off women would gain. Now, on the positive side, this argument did lead some to demand universal suffrage, so including all working class men as well. And despite the two sides, that's the middle-class WPSU and the working-class suffragists, often working together, ideological differences were always bubbling beneath the surface. Suffragists argued for women's suffrage, but always as part of a fight for more rights for all workers, whereas in contrast, the Pankhursts and their WPSU argued that the only struggle was votes for women. Now, interestingly, kind of ironically, the Pankhurst family's political roots were in the Independent Labour Party, which was very left-wing at the time, in Manchester. And although Emmeline, Christabel and Adela ended up abandoning working-class women and selling out their political roots in favour of a elitist fight by, in Christabel's own words, the feminine bourgeoisie, Sylvia was different. She went on to organise among the poor in East London. Now, Socialist Review of October last year describes how the ELFS, that's the East London Federation of Suffragettes, which was run by Sylvia, set up cost-price restaurants for hundreds of poor people every day and a free clinic for mothers of children. And Sylvia founded a communal nursery and set up a toy factory to raise funds. And she spoke alongside Irish socialist James Connolly in support of the workers striking in the Dublin lockout of 1913-14. Now, hardly surprisingly, her commitment to socialist politics and working class struggle caused a breach with the rest of her family and the WPSU. Now, this probably reached its epitome when, during World War One, while her sisters and mother were merrily handing out white feathers to conscientious objectors, her Women's Dreadnought paper, which was later renamed the Workers' Dreadnought, carried anti-war articles, and she opposed the Defence of the Realm Act in 1914 that undermined civil liberties. The more things change, the more they stay the same. And she supported strikes against the introduction of conscription. The WPSU East London Group eventually became the Workers' Socialist Federation, and its paper, The Women's Dreadnought, later became the Workers' Dreadnought during the 1917 Russian Revolution. And inspired by said revolution, Sylvia became a communist. So during the turbulent post-World War One period of revolutions, mutinies and strikes, the Workers' Socialist Federation became the first British socialist organisation to affiliate to the Third International, or the Communist International. Now, this is not to say that Sylvia didn't make any mistakes, but possibly going the other way. I mean, having fought so hard to extend the vote to women, in the 1920s her ultra-left views led her not to take part in elections. This is in contrast to Lenin, who at the time argued that the communists should take part in elections so as to be better placed to win over the majority of workers who were attracted to reformism and the Labour Party. Even so, though, until her death in 1960, Sylvia remained a socialist and fought injustice and imperialism. She was one of the first to understand the dangers of Italian and German fascism, and she was an anti-colonialist, especially championing the struggle of Ethiopia, or Abyssinia as it was called back in the day, against Mussolini. But going back to the suffragette movement as a whole, following World War One in 1918, women over 30 who met a property qualification finally got the vote. Now, 1918 is the often quoted date when women got the vote, but as you can tell, that wasn't the end of the story because it still excluded 40% of adult women. And it was another decade before women won equal voting rights to men, when all women over 21 got the right to fight. To vote, sorry. And even that wasn't the end of the fight. in terms of access to voting, it wasn't until 1967 that anyone over 18 got the right to vote, men or women, and we're still waiting for the voting age to be lowered to 16. And in terms of equality for women, it wasn't until the 1970s before the Equal Pay Act stopped blatant discrimination between men and women in terms of wages. And this was again brought in not out of the kindness of the establishment's heart, but following struggle by working class women, as you can see in the film Made in Dagenham. And even to this day, the pay gap between men and women hasn't been fully closed. And there's the ongoing struggle for greater access to abortion and against the degrading portrayal of women, which, if anything, is getting worse again with the growth of lap dancing clubs the general sort of bringing back of the new sexism. And the terrible treatment of young women in Rotherham who were sexually abused and the police refusing to take them seriously all goes to show that voting equality has not won full equality for women. But it was one hell of a step forward, and the lessons learnt from the suffragette struggle are important for contemporary struggles against sexism and for greater equality. Namely, we can't expect the establishment to give us equality without a fight. Every gain we make, we must fight for.
Thanks very much, Anthony. Very good.